Hello, Gallatin Valley. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, at 95.9 FM. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. I hope you have enjoyed an inspiring Earth Day weekend. We'll be playing a recent episode of Desert Oracle Radio in a few minutes, but first, let's catch up a bit. Last week, I put out the request for your stories of the unexplained. No one responded, so I think it's up to me to break the ice. Buckle in, here we go. I had set up my one-person tent on a campsite in Kodachrome Basin State Park in Utah. The campsite had an overlook with a beautiful view of the sunset. My tent was pitched next to a big rock and a juniper tree. After our dinner was cleaned up and the campfire had gone out, I snuggled into my tent and sleeping bag for a good night's sleep. Deep into the night, my sleep was interrupted by a broad weight slowly rolling on to me from my left. Next, I felt like a huge cat was kneading my shoulders and my quads. The thing stopped, but then it started again. I tried to say, "Get off me, go away," but little sound was coming out. The thing stopped, and I opened my eyes to see the moonlight shining through my sleeping bag. I wasn't scared as much as annoyed, but I began to wonder if this was a sleep paralysis thing, or had I upset some little people that might have dwellings in the tree or rock? Or was it something else? And honestly, I do think about those things, and we'll talk about those things again in another episode. But anyway, at that point, I made my apologies, said some prayers just in case, and had a perfect sleep the rest of the night. You can read about sleep paralysis and cultural interpretations at sleepeducation.org. And you can go down the rabbit hole looking for information about the little people in Native American lore, too. But for now, let's hear that Desert Oracle Radio episode. It was released April 14th, 2023, by Ken Lane. The title is Who by Fire, Who by War? And this one has no paranormal involved. Oh, and stay tuned after that because I'm taking you for a walk at the Indriland Wetlands right here in Bozeman.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and there's an uneasy feeling here at the station. An overwhelming urge to go off to war. To broadcast from my portable transmitter and a solar battery on the dusty road with Shay with the IRA riding alongside Ambrose Bierce through the deserts down in Mexico. Decades ago, working the police and politics and military beats at a newspaper down in Oceanside, I had an old worn copy of Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary. Right there next to the Associated Press style book and the white pages and the Thomas Brothers maps. I would flip through that dictionary looking for something that caught my eye, something relevant to whatever current circumstance, because Ambrose Bierce is a good editor. He teaches you to avoid false language. It was not long after The Old Gringo by Carlos Fuentes was published. That's a sort of fictionalized account of Bierce during his last crusade. Then somebody told me it was much better in Spanish, so I got the original Mexican edition one night in Tijuana at a bookstore. It was a bestseller on both sides of the border, the first novel by a Mexican author to be a U.S. bestseller. That's the truth. So I'd open both copies and compare, read lines out loud, look up the phrases I could not understand, most of them. I still can't speak Spanish. That's atrocious. And ordering food and drink does not count unless you have a hunger or you have a thirst. But Ambrose Bierce keeps haunting me. A year or two back, the TV people asked me to drive to West Hollywood and sit in a rich man's house and talk about Ambrose Bierce, about his romantic disappearance. So I did, but the TV people were upset. There was a misunderstanding. They'd sent an email and said, "Do you know about any of these stories?" And they listed two or three stories. I said, "I know about Ambrose Bierce, about his disappearance, as much as anybody knows. It's a mystery, after all." The TV man in the email said if I did not like any of those stories, they would offer me something else another time. I said, "No, I like that Ambrose Bierce story." Well, I get there and I talk about Bierce and Pancho Villa and the revolution, and an hour or so goes by and that's it. But it's not it, because they want me to be an expert on the other things too that I don't know anything about. It was my fault. I misunderstood the assignment, so I had to fake my way through whatever the other things were. I don't remember. Probably about a YouTuber disappearing while trying to find a secret Bitcoin mine. They did not ask me back again. I broke some rule. I was confused by the electronic communications. And then William Shatner went to space and had his psyche completely shattered, which greatly annoyed the nude-eyed Amazon guy who was trying to spray champagne on his underlings. And William Shatner doesn't do that TV program anymore either, although the reruns will air until the last boomer dies on whatever cable channel. I hear from people when they come across it in motels sometimes, where they've still got cable TV. It's all right. It worked out fine. And a person should be careful about going on television. The problem was the pandemic, the lockdown. I had not been anywhere in a while, so going to Los Angeles for an overnight seemed like a good idea. Especially if the people from William Shatner's mystery show were paying for the travel. But I I still think a lot about Ambrose Bierce. The haunting grows more urgent. This is Desert Oracle Radio with soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. For Wilhurst Magazine, the Alta Journal, from time to time, and I wonder what kind of war they could send me to cover. One last romantic mission before vanishing forever. No return address. Who doesn't dream of vanishing forever in this virtual reality prison world? There's this terrific book about Leonard Cohen serving as a troubadour, a sort of bugle corps man, a freelance musical soldier, and the Yom Kippur War. The story is incredible, and until recently, it was barely known. It was a footnote in the long, interesting artistic life of Leonard Cohen. So there's Leonard Cohen at age 38, burnt out, tired of making records, bored of trying to be a poet, unsure of whether or not it matters. Tired of his easy and decadent life, which back then was mostly spent on the island of Hydra with his small family. But his young son was small anyway. The rest of them were normal sized. The adults. And so in the midst of a spiritual crisis, a psychic breakdown, he hops a plane to Tel Aviv, did not bring anything, not even a guitar. Guitars are tyranny when you're expected to make product with them, generate content all the time. They should then be abandoned or stomped into splinters. Well, I won't give away the book because it's worth reading, but he went to war. Leonard Cohen went to the war. No assignment, no commission, but sometimes God gives you a mission if you show up in the right place. The book is called Who by Fire? Leonard Cohen and the Sinai by Maddie Friedman. The Those are dangerous books to read. That's a dangerous sort of book to get into when you're restless. They are loaded guns. I guess this happens to everybody in different phases of one's life. But as the years go on, I become reluctantly aware that the great crisis requiring my specific genius may not be forthcoming. The great movement, the grand human adventure may not be summoning me to battle in the time remaining. I would gladly join a lost cause, a group of fanatics, a guerrilla war, anything without a human resources department, really. Without items to complete on DocuSign. Without a requirement to log into the financial institution website where there are always cheerful photographs of the people that banks redline out of all the loans. The government leaguers, the truth seekers. The ragged armies of the night. I sympathize and empathize with all the outlaws trying to make a noise in this blanked out world. Liberate the house elves, you know, shoot down the aliens, lock up the CEOs, levitate the Pentagon. Under cover of darkness.
Paradise lies Damascus, right at the edge of the Arabian Desert. Here the soil is so rich that even the laziest farmer can make a good living with his crude old plow. Damascus is the oldest inhabited city on earth. We can trace its history back 4,500 years, but it must be much older than that. For the Orientals believe that this is where the Garden of Eden used to be. And if Adam and Eve used a plow, it must have looked something like this. History tells us that when Muhammad got his first and only glimpse of Damascus from a hilltop, he exclaimed, "Man can have but one paradise. Mine is fixed above." And so he passed on. It was on this spot that Muhammad made his great renunciation. However, as we are not prophets, we decided to take a chance. And so we went down into Damascus, where we found a picturesque jumble of modern houses, old mosques, minarets, and still older ruins that bear silent witness to the many fierce battles that were fought for it down through the centuries. The tower in the distance is the Minaret of the Bride, built 1,200 years ago. These ruins surround the tomb of Saladin, the great warrior who fought the Crusaders and stopped Richard the Lionheart. Between ancient Roman columns, we get glimpses of the Minaret of Giza, the oldest and tallest tower in Syria. The Muslims believe that on Judgment Day, Christ will appear on this minaret. The courtyard of the Umayyadi, the oldest and most imposing mosque in Damascus. Partially destroyed by fire, it is now being rebuilt. Here once stood a pagan temple, which was converted into a Byzantine basilica dedicated to St. John the Baptist 1,600 years ago. 400 years later, this basilica was made over into a Mohammedan mosque. Yet the Muslims still revere the memory of St. John, whose head, enclosed in a box of gold, is said to be buried under the mosque. We see the famous street called Straight, known to Abraham and King David, and where Ananias went to the house of Judas to inquire for Saul of Tarsus. Shops called bazaars line this busy street, which follows a straight line right across the city from east to west. Sheep raising is profitable here, thanks to the rich pasture lands around Damascus. And wool is an important item of commerce. Caravans of camels bring the wool to the marketplace or deliver it to distant points. A general laziness pervades the whole place. Camels move about slowly, majestically, and some of them, realizing that they have reached their journey's end, squat down to rest without waiting for an invitation. Now, could any woman resist the temptation of buying this beautiful glove box? I ask you. The string of the bow is wound around the shaft of the lathe and makes a turn. The accuracy of the final result is astonishing. And this is how the grooves are cut into the metal with a graving tool. I testify there is no God but God. Typical Arabian coffee pot. And a brass bowl with Arabic inscriptions taken from the Koran. That is like no other antiquity, built by the Turkish Sultan Selim for the weary pilgrims returning from Mecca. The muezzin chants his call to prayer. Come to Mohammed is the apostle of God. And as the Muslims reverently kneel in accordance with their faith, we silently leave Damascus, the magic city, immortal.
Resumed Identity, the review is a form of welcome by Ambrose Pierce. One summer night, a man stood on a low hill overlooking a wide expanse of forest and field. By the full moon hanging low in the west, he knew what he might not have known otherwise. That it was near the hour of dawn. A light mist lay along the earth, partly veiling the lower features of the landscape. But above it, the taller trees showed in well-defined masses against a clear sky. Two or three farmhouses were visible through the haze, but in none of them, naturally, was a light. Nowhere, indeed, was any sign or suggestion of life except the barking of a distant dog, which, repeated with mechanical iteration, served rather to accentuate than dispel the loneliness of the scene. The man looked curiously about him on all sides as one who, among familiar surroundings, is unable to determine his exact place and part in the scheme of things. It is so, perhaps, that we shall act when, risen from the dead, we await the call to judgment. 100 yards away was a straight road showing white in the moonlight, endeavoring to orient himself as a surveyor or navigator might say. The man moved his eyes slowly along its visible length and at a distance of a quarter mile to the south of his station saw, dim and gray in the haze, a group of horsemen riding to the north. Behind them were men afoot, marching in column, with dimly gleaming rifles aslant above their shoulders. They moved slowly and in silence. Another group of horsemen, another regiment of infantry, another and another, all in unceasing motion toward the man's point of view, past it and beyond. A battery of artillery followed. The cannoneers riding with folded arms on limber and caisson. And still the interminable procession came out of the obscurity to south and passed into the obscurity to north with never a sound of voice, nor hoof, nor wheel. The man could not rightly understand. He thought himself deaf. He said so and heard his own voice, although it had an unfamiliar quality that almost alarmed him. It disappointed his ear's expectancy in the matter of timbre and resonance. But he was not deaf, and that for the moment sufficed. Then he remembered that there are natural phenomena to which someone has given the name acoustic shadows. If you stand in an acoustic shadow, there is one direction from which you will hear nothing. At the Battle of Gaines Mill, one of the fiercest conflicts of the Civil War, with 100 guns in play, spectators a mile and a half away on the opposite side of the Chickahominy Valley heard nothing of what they clearly saw. The bombardment of Port Royal, heard and felt at St. Augustine, 150 miles to the south, was inaudible 2 miles to the north in a still atmosphere. A few days before the surrender at Appomattox, a thunderous engagement between the commands of Sheridan and Pickett was unknown to the latter commander, a mile in the rear of his own line. These instances were not known to the man of whom we write, but less striking ones of the same character had not escaped his observation. He was profoundly disquieted, but for another reason than the uncanny silence of that moonlight march. Good Lord, he said to himself. And again it was as if another had spoken his thought. If those people are what I take them to be, we have lost the battle and they are moving on Nashville. Then came a thought of self and apprehension. A strong sense of personal peril, such as in another we call fear. He stepped quickly into the shadow of a tree, and still the silent battalions moved slowly forward in the haze. The chill of a sudden breeze upon the back of his neck drew his attention to the quarter whence it came, and turning to the east, he saw a faint gray light along the horizon. The first sign of returning day. This increased his apprehension. I must get away from here, he thought, or I shall be discovered and taken. He moved out of the shadow, walking rapidly toward the graying east, and from the safer seclusion of a clump of cedars, he looked back. The entire column had passed out of sight. The straight white road lay bare and desolate in the moonlight. Puzzled before, he was now inexpressibly astonished. So swift a passing of so slow an army, he could not comprehend it. Minute after minute passed unnoted. He had lost his sense of time. He sought with a terrible earnestness a solution to the mystery, but sought in vain. When at last he roused himself from his abstraction, the sun's rim was visible above the hills. But in the new conditions, he found no other light than that of day. His understanding was involved as darkly in doubt as before. On every side lay cultivated fields showing no sign of war and war's ravages. From the chimneys of the farmhouses, thin ascensions of blue smoke signaled preparations for a day's peaceful toil. Having stilled its immemorial allocution to the moon, the watchdog was assisting a man who, prefixing a team of mules to the plow, was flatting and sharpening contentedly at his task. The hero of this tale stared stupidly at the pastoral picture as if he had never seen such a thing in all his life. Then he put his hand to his head, passed it through his hair, and withdrawing it, attentively considered the palm, a singular thing to do. Apparently reassured by this act, he walked confidently toward the road.
As I mentioned in our last show, the whole week leading up to Earth Day was filled with events. Last Sunday, the Sacagawea Audubon chapter led a walk at the Indreland wetlands where they have been restoring beaver ponds. I talked with them and with regular users of the area too. Enjoy! Here I am. I'm at the beaver pond and it is Sunday, April 16th, 2023, and I forgot to bring my little windsock, so we'll be getting raw files from here. I can hear an American crow. I can hear a Canada goose. I'm pretty sure I heard some Cassin's finches walking in. But unfortunately, I largely hear the interstate and trains. I hope that gets better. The habitat is here, but I wonder about how the birds can communicate. Oh, there's a pair of something just flew through. Very flappy. They look like they might be a pair of raptors of some kind, like falcons. Anyway, okay, I'm going to turn this off for now and see if it quiets down. Maybe I'll talk to some other users. I'm walking with another user of this beaver pond, and he comes out here frequently. He said he saw a sandhill crane flying overhead. Oh, he's showing me where one of the beaver dams is, the dens, I guess, right? Cool. So have you pretty much gotten used to the trains out here?
Yeah, it's kind of fun, you know, seeing the trains drive by, stop, and do whatever they're doing.
Good. I'm not used to it yet.
Nah, yeah. Some people will come out here with a hand radio and listen to them whenever they stop and stuff, and get their frequency and just hear what they're doing. Huh.
So if you come out here frequently, like what's the most memorable animal, either bird or otherwise, that you've seen?
I don't know, like, probably just a beaver, you know, just being able to just watch it swim around, do its thing. You never know when it comes out or doesn't want to come out. Like, I don't know, but you can just see random things, like muskrats swimming around, especially with, like, all the baby birds coming out, you know, seeing them, and then kind of how the wild is, you know. You can have 1 week where it's a mom of a whole flock, and the next week she only has, like, two babies with her, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's kind of, I would say, the coolest, like, nearest part of nature of Bozeman, you know, where you don't really have to go that far to see it. There's a ton of birds, like, especially in the summer and stuff. They're just, and all the trees chirping.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's nature in our backyard.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
There are crows flying around. There's a pair of them coming close. But if you have binoculars, you can see there's a big group of them. Just kind of, it almost looks like they're following the path of the railroad. The path is not muddy, which is nice. It's good to hear the sound of that under my feet instead of the sound of crunching snow, though that's a nice sound too. But I'm ready. I'm ready for the seasons to warm up a bit. Today, the songbirds seem to be on the end farthest from the railroad tracks of this straight path. And I can't help but wonder if that's because they can hear each other a little better. I'm sitting on the bench at the at that quiet end of the path, and there's a mallard, a male mallard, swimming in the open water. His head is just that beautiful iridescent blue. And I heard a magpie and a red-winged blackbird. And there are some other birds I haven't identified yet, but gonna look and listen. Well, there was a little drama I just witnessed. That first mallard that I saw was approached by a second mallard, and then they both took off, and I noticed there was a female mallard sitting on the snow next to the water. So I imagine that was a little bit of rivalry going on, you know, one guy chasing off the other guy. I love it. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. They're both back. I believe they are courting the favors of that female. They're talking, too. She just took off, and they are hot on her tail. That was a northern flicker. I can see him in the top of a tree.
I'm not necessarily going to know the answer, so it's okay. Up to you.
So this is a guy that's come in, I think, with the Audubon Group. Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah, I was okay. Them.
Yeah, and he's going to tell me the difference in the behavior between a redhead and a mallard. So go ahead.
Yeah, behavior's tough, but the redhead, and there's two ducks that have a red head. One is the canvasback, and one is the redhead. And canvasbacks are larger, if I remember right, and they have a really sloping profile. And they, generally you're going to see them, I don't want to say they're a diving duck, but you'll see them in deeper water than this. The redhead, when I see them in the spring, and I seem to only see them in the spring or the fall, mostly spring. In other words, I don't know of any local areas where they nest or stay all summer long. They seem to also be on deeper water. And right now, we've got a lot of ice right here and a very fairly shallow pond. And I see the mallards that you had mentioned a little bit earlier right now. Let's just make sure they are indeed. Yeah, it's a male and a female, a hen and a drake. And the ones that I saw that probably were mallards were further out. In any case, but they're the only two ducks that have a reddish head. And they both have a grayish body. And a little harder to identify. But behavior-wise, I honestly don't know the distinct differences between the two. I just recall the canvasback is larger. But it wouldn't be hard to look it up on my phone at any second.
Okay.
Yeah, so we could do that. We could actually take a look and see how often they occur, or even if they nest in the local area. The internet has provided us with so many opportunities to gather information quickly and do research quickly. It's just incredible. So maybe that keeps me from actually learning these things. I'm not sure. That's a separate question.
Well, you were talking about walking like a redhead or walking like a mallard.
That's a good point. That when I say something like that, I'm using a familiarity that I'm accustomed to. And I don't think I've ever actually seen a redhead or a canvasback actually walking on land or ice. Now, they're totally capable of it. They, you know, they nest probably shorelines and such, or islands, marshlands, you know, that, as I say, they don't necessarily nest here. Whoops, excuse me, there's three ducks flying. They're probably also mallards. On the move, they are mallards. So, you know, they were just doing the typical mallard waddle. So I'm not, in a sense, I'm so familiar, or I feel I'm so familiar with mallards, I'm using that as an indicator. And if it's a little bit different, if there's something a little bit different, and what I had mentioned to you when I first arrived was I thought I'd seen a different color, which made me wonder if maybe it was something else out there. But angle of light, which you also mentioned, has a big impact on our perception of color. And of course, many ducks and many birds, particularly the males, have an iridescence, and that iridescence can be very deceptive. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, there's a lone duck flying back there, and I just... It's a mallard hen. So, of course, mallards are so common. And sometimes when we think about this, even mallards, you get them from one angle, it looks iridescent green. Another angle, it looks almost black on their
head. Yeah, today I saw one of these same ones over here, and at first I was seeing iridescent blue.
There you go. That is a characteristic. And I see that in fur, too. So angle of light has a big impact on the colors that we perceive. And now I'm actually seeing a pair of mallards walking out there, and they're right in the location where I last saw that duck, that lone duck that I had seen when I first arrived. So I'm not sure if I gave you any new information, but it's conversational, and that's always fun.
It is. That's what this
is always
about.
Fun to share it. Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If I can hold my balance.
Here's another bench.
So are you a member of Audubon?
I am. I'm very happy to be a member of the national and the local organization for many years, but it has not been able to claim as much of my time as I would like it to, and I was thrilled when this event opportunity showed up because it was on a day and time, a Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. The weather is inviting, and of course with Earth Day coming and climate, all of these things I care deeply about, and I needed to say, hey, I need to be out here in a place where I care deeply about.
Thank you.
Good.
Go stand next to you.
So, this is the culvert, and this was the second beaver lodge that we had, and we do know that there's some muskrats using it also. We call it their little condominium in there, so the beavers allow it. But this is the culvert. So all your water is coming out of the highlights there, the Highlight Glen area. Filtrating down to here, goes through the culvert, hits Story Mill Ditch, which then hits the East Gallatin River. What's happened is this water has been really warmed by all the development. So our goal is to clean it. When it gets to this culvert, we're putting in a brand new culvert here. And it's going. This pond will go down 16 feet. Mm-hmm. So all that clean water will push down into the bedrock, cool it off. And so when it transfers over on this side and into the East Gallatin, it will be a lot cooler. So that cold water, I don't know if you've seen that documentary, Cold Water. The East Gallatin is the most imperiled river in Montana right now because Bozeman's warming it up. And it's turning it from a pristine trout fishery to more of a warm water fisheries. So we're trying to help it go back or stay trout fishing by cooling the water down. So that's one of the big things that we're doing here. So
it's a bottomless culvert then?
It'll be a vegetation culvert.
Okay.
I really would like to put a glass top here so you could look down into it. Wouldn't that be cool? Everybody goes, I don't think you can do that. And I'm like, oh, you can always get something done, right?
Yeah.
So
if there's a bar in Montana with a glass bottom, there could be that too.
That's what I say. Well, we wanted to have windows to the wetland. We saw a lot of wetlands that have windows. If you walk down a hill and you look into them, but these are going to be pretty muddy.
Right.
So, but if the water is clean here, it'd be fun to watch the fish. We do have little fish in here. I don't know what kind. I'm not a fisher's biologist, but you can smell the wetland degrading here from the winter. Some people come down here and they said there's a sewer leak. And I'm like, well, the sewer line over there. But it's more. And you can see a cage down there. We built a.
Oh, yeah, I see it.
Do you see it? Yeah. We built that cage 2 years ago to prevent the beavers from filling up the culvert. And so then they built mud all around the cage.
Wow.
Cage was way above the ground. And you see that pile of sticks right there? That's ones that we took out of the culvert. They refused to use the sticks they've already used. They do. And it was so funny. But we had a rake down there, a brand new rake with a wooden handle, and they decided to use that. So it was new. They hadn't used it. So we're trying to
We've reached out to Quiet Parks. It's an international organization of scientists that come in to urban areas and try to make their parks more quiet. So we would like this to be more quiet. What do we do to make it more quiet is our question to them. So
they have any ideas?
Well, right now our idea is to put up berms, but that might not. There's certain vegetation you can use to help quiet it down. And also most of the sound is coming from the interstate when the wind is blowing from the east.
Or the trains.
The trains, yes, those too. But the interstate noise actually is...
Yeah, it's constant.
But I'm
what other projects are you guys working on?
Well, our restoration, the mitigation bank finalizing, the final instrument it's called, is what we're working on right now. It's already gone out to public comment, and it's in the final stages. As soon as we have approval from the Montana Rail Link and Burlington Northern for our design, then we will move forward with mitigation.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So.
Yay.
Let me go.
Yes. Thank you.
There are a lot of there are a lot of pollen. There are a lot of insects that are particular to foraging on a specific plant species, and we found some of the bee researchers. MSU has a bee museum, so that's kind of cool. If you want to Google something, they have a huge collection of Montana native bees. There's a lot of increasing research on Montana native bees. We have potentially the most bee diversity of any state. But there's one bee species that is an oil collector. So it collects the essential oils from a flower and not the pollen necessarily, or the nectar. And it is specific to a species of loosestrife, which is a wetland plant that just has like a yellow flower. And the loosestrife is down kind of where the berm meets the tracks. And we found the flower and the bee there this last year. So the gal who does the bee museum for the university, and actually we went and photographed it up by the up on the Galligator, not here. But yeah, they also have it up there. And the... Yeah.
It's not really
No, it's very native to... Yeah, I don't even... People probably didn't know about it before that long ago because it's so unusual. Both in that it forages on a specific plant and that it is an oil collector, which is... So it has these extra long legs to keep its body actually kind of away from the pollen, which normally a bee would want to be all over the pollen, but this one, it doesn't. So its legs are a little bit longer. It's kind of funny. Maybe I should post something like that on our page sometime.
That would be fun.
And then this was like only a botanist could appreciate, but I was with Matt from the university, and we found a couple of unique species of sedge, which are a wetland plant, that he got really excited about, and so I was like really excited about it too. But it's a really tall sedge, and it grows like in some of these willow thickets down here.
Does here anyone do any classes? For plant identification?
We did it at the BioBlitz. Okay. I don't know if that's planned for this year's BioBlitz.
There's the workshop from U of M. They have a grant. University of Montana has a grant on wetland grasses that they're doing a workshop.
Oh.
Maybe in July. I don't know if I have a date.
Oh, here they are.
They usually nest over in the 15 acres of Montana Department of Transportation wetland over there. It's actually already...
It's got a clicker.
If you just believe,
exactly.
If you just believe, you can climb. If you just believe, you can duck here.
Exactly.
I want to thank all those that appreciate the wetlands in Bozeman. At my house, the pine siskins, Cassin's finches, Clark's nutcrackers, and all the rest are back at the feeders, having made it through that last spring storm that dumped about 8 inches of new wet snow up here. I really want to hear from you at 406-404-6246. With your explained and unexplained experiences or anything else you'd like to tell me. Once again, that phone number is 406-404-6246. Gallatin Valley
Thank you for listening. You'll hear me Sundays at 7 p.m. and a rebroadcast Monday morning at 9 right here on KGBM Bozeman, 95.9 FM. Until then, sweet dreams and stay well, Gallatin Valley.